Hello, my name's James Trupany, and in this episode of Telling Stories, we're going to look at one of the great legends of hardcore, Abdullah the Butcher, in the Rough Guide to Violence Part 2. Abdullah is, as Abdullah does, you know, he's been around forever. He's been a guy that's been there for a very long time, and he recently retired at a big show while he celebrated the life and times of Giant Baba, one of his friends, one of his mentors. There are some problems with Abdullah. His character is kind of derivative of the Sheik and Wild Bill Curry. There are concerns about his health and the way he treated himself and other people who were in his trust. But at the end of the day, he did make an awful lot of money, and we'd be silly not to learn from the things that he did and how he made wrestling a better place, even if a lot of the time we see Abdullah in a negative light these days. He was incredibly special. He always will be. The Butcher. The Rough Guide to Violence Part 2. Let's get some ice cream, champ. Riding with the Butcher. For as long as I have been watching American wrestling, I've been hearing and reading stories about Abdullah the Butcher. The matches, the blood, the violence, eating live chickens on TV, or appearing to. The myth is wholly part of the man. He has a special part of wrestling history that lies deep in the territory system. Lessons can be learned, both positive and negative, from his career, but the way he looked, still even now at 73 years old, 360 pounds on a 6-foot frame, was the first thing that fired up your imagination. He now walks very, very slowly, but his ring style is the same as it ever was. Those wild staring eyes, same as they ever were. That aura, that presence, that distilled sense of fear and danger is still there after all these years. Larry Shreve was born of 8 children in Windsor, Ontario, Canada, to a poor, hard-working black family. As a child, he showed a lot of spirited cash initiative, selling papers on the street corner. He would start crying until somebody came along and asked him what the matter was. Through his tears, he would explain that he would still have to sell all of his papers before he could go home. The mark would, of course, buy the papers. It was Canada, after all. And then he would move to the next block and start again. That wasn't until one day someone caught him out and took him home to see his father, who was not best pleased. However, he clearly had a performance-based mind. As a pastime, he began studying karate and judo. There is often an incredulity to this, however, for years he wore a judoka badge on his tights and produced his karate license during a shoot interview, so I think we can assume he holds a strong affinity for the sport. Whatever made his mind work so fast, and whatever made him so tough, would stand him in good stead throughout his career. His natural size and look attracted the attention of Montreal promoter Jack Breton, who invited him down to training with his local crew. He made his debut at 17 years old and began the long, arduous task of finding a place for himself in the wrestling world. He began to realize that standing out was his best option. He began as Pussycat Pickens, Kuro Jiu-Jitsu, and Zealous Amara, names that would fade into the distance. For a while, he took a rest from the wrestling wars. He was offered a job in General Motors factory based on his wrestling exploits and feats of strength, telling Lee, of course, that it was in Detroit. After a while, he got the bug again and was invited to one of those outlaw promotions they had worked for in his earlier days. Abdullah made his full transformation at this point, and he was clearly influenced by the Sheik and Bill Curry. In Ontario, he returned to face Gino Brito, Jack Britton's son, which ended when Abdullah attacked Gino with a chair, breaking it over his head and beating him with a leg. That caused a stir. He began to get recognized as a surefire attraction, working east to Seattle and then up to Vancouver. He found his formula for success almost by accident. When he got to a new territory, usually on recommendation, no video in those days, he would find himself on the losing end at the opening of a card as an unknown would. Working his monster heel style, a promoter one night wants him to lose in a lengthy opener. After watching the match, the promoter sent word to the referee that he should win, realizing he had a star on his hands. At the end of the match, he raised his finger to the sky in a soft voice, but loud enough to project to the audience, "Me, me." A booking style was born. The basic play of his career was formed in those few months. Go into a territory, scare everyone witless, destroy everyone in your path, preferably have the State Athletic Commission pull their hair out and giving TV producers nightmares, work your way to the top and move on. Like the NWA heavyweight champion and Andre the Giant, he would be a roaming attraction, never outstaying his welcome. He realized that a little of what he had to offer was a good thing. He became the most controversial wrestler in the world. His character couldn't speak, thus pushing his heat further because he always offered the best and highest profile managers in the territory. The list is long and distinguished. Number one Paul Jones in Mid-Atlantic, Playboy Gary High in Texas, Oliver Humperdinck, James J. Dillon, Paul Heyman, Paul Ellering, Skander Akbar. The very cream of the crop in heat-producing management was at his disposal. He took to using weapons like the Sheik, only rather than a taped up pencil, he used a taped up fork. It was actually reminded him of what put food in his mouth. While the Sheik favoured a heat-getting prayer routine at the beginning of his matches, he preferred an all-out attack, and the matches were brutal. He worked so many places it was really hard to give him a narrative to his career, but by looking at his title reigns as brief and as regional as they were, it gives us a picture of what the man could do in a short period of time. His first stint of championship success came in 1967 as NWA Canadian and World Tag Team Champions, the Vancouver version, in Western Canada with Eddie Graham, a title he would regain in 68 with Armand Hussein. He then moved on to Calgary, where he won the NWA Canadian Heavyweight title in 1970. He added a Stampede North American title to his growing collection in February of the same year. He would hold it for another three times throughout the 70s. Then it would be on to the NWF World title, Johnny Power's Northeastern Independent that worked the Northeastern Seaboard, defeating Big Cat Ernie Ladd in Ankeren, Ohio. In 74 he shows up in New Zealand to take their version of the NWA British Commonwealth title. In 75 he's back in Japan taking the PWF United States title from the Destroyer in All Japan Pro Wrestling. While working for All Japan, he had two championship carnival tournaments in 76 and 79. Alongside Ray Candy, he would win an NWA International Tag Team Championship title in 78, a banner year because he would also defeat Billy Robinson for the PWF World title. One more major title would come along in 1980, a United National Championship, also in All Japan. After that, he didn't need belts. You could hear him coming from 100 miles away. Two-thirds of the Triple Crown, Stampede and Vancouver's most prestigious titles. He wasn't just considered a draw, he was also considered someone who could be a main event-styled wrestler with any opponent, and it is worth looking in depth at those high-profile matches to get a flavour of what the Butcher could do. Abdullah had many matches that featured the big Japanese draws of the era. The question is where to start. I chose the recently deceased British wrestling legend Billy Robinson. The earliest encounter between the two I could find was in 1976. Abdullah begins the match by throwing Billy to the floor and taking him to the table where he proceeds to pound him mercilessly. What surprises you is the speed with which he can move for a man of his size. Just reaching his prime, he could move his 350 pounds around quite swiftly and clearly gives Billy a hard time in that manner of approach. This should be a horrible mishmash of styles, hardcore versus pure wrestling, and while Billy may have found this awkward, it was certainly entertaining. The crowd was hot for this match too. The normally quiet and respectful Japanese audience of that era were loud and raucous throughout, a surefire sign of something special occurring. Abdullah sealed his advantage in this encounter by ramming Billy's head into the ring post and resorting to his trademark fork. In return, Billy produced a hard-striking offense with headbutts and vicious kicks. They went at each other relentlessly, and while it wasn't wrestling classic that Billy was known for, it showed his ability to hang tough with the man who was arguably the world's best brawler at the time. It also whet the appetite for the next serious encounter. That would be for the PWF Heavyweight Championship in 78. It was a best-of-three-fall affair. They both began the match in true sports wrestling fashion, circling each other and testing the waters. This is much more of a pure wrestling match which highlights Billy's strengths. In fact, Billy worked a much more chain wrestling match than any of the others Abdullah had in this period, and he was more than happy to keep up. He did make distinct efforts to slow the pace. He was clearly blown up about 10 minutes into the bout and needed some time, but the opening few moments are straight out the Wigan playbook. Abdullah works quite a few basic submissions in himself. This was a title match, and he was clearly keen to give a title match style performance. Billy also used a lot of old school British strikes, forearm uppercuts and kneeless, and some distinctly non-British ones like the knee drop across the throat. It was only then that Abdullah got frustrated and broke out the signature headbutts. This series built to an innovative belly-to-back backbreaker manoeuvre from Billy taking the first fall, and the second fall saw Robinson clearly trying to put Abdullah away with big moves that got the first fall, and as the frustration mounts, so did the opportunities for Abdullah to come back. In fact, as Abdullah takes his beating, the story of the match shifts in focus to Billy's leg as he trips and gets caught in the ropes. This would result in a submission, the second fall in the match, as Robinson could not continue. In fact, it echoes the title match he and Vern Gagne had for the AWA title. Unwilling to job, Billy took an injury out, protecting his reputation. Very important, especially for a gimmick man like Abdullah. In fact, shooters generally seem to have a high opinion of Abdullah. As Abdullah tells it, early in his career, when he was resident worker in Toronto territory, he was to work the main event in the NWA World Championship bout with Lou Thesz. All week long, his colleagues told him, "Oh, you're going to get it. Saturday night when Lou gets here, he hates gimmick men." Possibly after hearing what happened to the Sheik, which I discussed in episode 2 of this podcast, you can imagine Abdullah wasn't in the best frames of mind on the night of the big fight. What surprised him even more was when he heard a tap on the dressing room window and opened it to find Lou stood on the other side. He climbed out of his dressing room window, walked around the building so as not to be seen, Clearly thinking his reputation had preceded him, he wanted to let the young Abdullah know that everything would be okay. "Anything you want to do, champ, I'm fine with," was his simple message, and he went back to his dressing room. A more independently verifiable story was told by the Dynamite Kid in his biography. "I know how he treated those that didn't treat him or his friends fairly. A new wrestler swung into Stampede and caught flak for taking liberties with younger members of the roster. When he got to Abdullah, he flung into the ropes and caught him in a bear hug. Sensing trouble, Abdullah put his razor-sharp fingernails to his throat and whispered, 'Put me down, champ.' He did as he was told and didn't take any liberties with anyone for the rest of his stay." Abdullah's modus operandi in those early matches within the territory was to grab attention. I mean, if you're going to make a name for yourself, you start at the top. By the late 70s, Harley Race was undoubtedly the most respected wrestler in the world. A multi-time world champion, his visits to All Japan were highly anticipated. Having made his name as a gravel-voiced heel, his pure wrestling aesthetic and bump-heavy style made him a natural babyface in Japan. Abdullah did his best to reinforce that character change in the mid-70s encounter. Back in his youth, his speed was actually a lot of his offense. Jumping Harley before the bell, he rammed him into the ring post and Harley bled profusely, almost to the point of not being able to see. Selling the blood, he spends a bit of time on the receiving end of Abdullah's abuse. However, he manages to gain his bearings and he attacks Abdullah with the first thing that comes to hand. A crutch, which he promptly smashes into Abdullah and then into more manageable pieces, slicing and dicing the butcher before both are disqualified. The crowd raged on in the background. Abdullah's presence is such a mind warp in Japan in the mid-70s. As the wrestling environment was so sports-orientated, he stuck out like a sore thumb. And while he could have done those sports-style matches if he wanted to, his occasional forays into ultra-violence left the crowd gasping for air. By the end of the 70s, Abdullah felt his time in All Japan was up, and he switched camps to New Japan Pro Wrestling. Waiting for him was a high-profile feud with the ace of the company, Antonio Inoki. But to Western fans, the most remembered match was the showdown with Hulk Hogan, just at the beginning of Hogan's face run in the company. The match itself was surprisingly watchable for two powerhouse wrestlers. They swapped power moves off the lockup, and Hogan showed his main event style even then. The match has parallels to his efforts amongst monster heels like Big Boss Man and King Kong Bundy that were staples of his WWE title run. Clearly, he was paying attention. From Abdullah's point of view, he had some very interesting points to discuss. Firstly, the Stampede influence was in full effect. He takes a posting face-first, Bret Hart style. Now, Bret always took that move face-first on the grounds it looked more realistic. That way, it was easy to block, thus reducing the injury risk. But as this happened so rarely to Abdullah, this is the only occasion I saw him take an Irish whip in any of his matches I've seen, it could be surmised that Bret got the idea from him. They would have spent a lot of time together in the late 70s and early 80s. The other point is, Abdullah basically no-selling Hogan's Japanese finisher, the Axe Bomber, his heavy-duty lariat that finished most of his matches on that side of the Pacific. Though Hogan didn't hit him cleanly, you would have thought he would have at least got a two count out of it. I would also point out the most noticeable visual aspects of this match would be the amount of blood loss on Hogan's part. They both clearly saw this as an important match to their careers and gave it their all in more ways than one. Protecting both of them, this match ended in a double count out. However, this showed the Japanese fans the lengths Hogan would go to, and while Abdullah is at his heel best here, Hogan is no goody two-shoes, biting and gouging and forking his way to survival. Another perennial face champion to wrestle Abdullah in Japan would be Dusty Rhodes. Big Dust took a different approach to Abdullah, though. The man who took brawling to a whole other level in the NWA wasn't about to stand by and let Abdullah take all the hardcore glory. Any resemblance this had to a wrestling match was purely coincidental. As Abdullah jumps Dusty outside the ring and brings the weapons into play early, it was all Abdullah, showing his usual restraint. For the first 5 minutes before Dusty was able to take control of the fork and starts remonstrating with the referee over what are legal and what is not, in fact, so caught up in the conversation, he just starts pounding on Peter Takahashi as Abdullah recovers enough to get out of the ring. Takahashi has no option but to call for the bell. Noticing a pattern? Every one of these high-profile career-making matches hasn't ended in a clean victory for anyone except Abdullah's win over Billy Robinson, which can't be called comprehensive. While Abdullah understood his worth to any company, he would oblige his opponents too, knowing that there was always money in a rematch, if you could make people want it bad enough. In the mid-80s, Abdullah had switched allegiances back to All Japan Pro Wrestling, and in 1986 joined Giant Baba for his 30th anniversary match against Andre and Stan Hansen. This was somewhat of a bizarre teaming, but for a fun night out at Kurikan, fans were in for a treat. This match, giving the three face participants, is much more of a straight wrestling match. Before the bell rings, Abdullah is shown talking to himself rather than through a manager, and he wonders aloud if he can trust Baba, which is shown later when Abdullah gets frustrated. While the match opens up, he goes toe-to-toe with Hansen on Andre in a pure wrestling power sense, which is up to AJPW's American-style product standard at the time. In a few years, it would have looked as dated as Flair's and Mil Máscaras, but for its era, it was a pretty good bout. It didn't really need to be. The star quality in the match and the bizarre teaming of Baba and Abdullah was enough to keep the crowd interested. Of course, they have to fall out over the fork and Stan, Andre and Baba triple team him for the win. So Baba even lost in his own anniversary show. Abdullah was right. He couldn't trust him. In a kayfabe sense, of course. Baba was one of the most beloved and generous promoters in the world, and Abdullah, in private, was often considered to be a kind and careful man. He gave the Dynamite Kid a gold watch for his retirement present. Those trips to Japan are so well documented because Japanese fans love their wrestling. WWE doesn't own any of the rights. Because Japanese companies don't have to worry about old product, they can stay on YouTube. Another such place, thankfully for us, is Puerto Rico. The small island does deserve a chapter unto itself in this history of violence, and I shall get to that in time. For now, though, we have to express how it was in the perfect home away from home from Abdullah throughout the 80s and 90s. The WWC territory, World Wrestling Council, ran huge shows during the 80s, with its hero Carlos Colon on top. Their simple booking philosophy of a hugely over-local hero facing and defeating a slew of monsters was nothing new, but its presentation and delivery were superb for its home audience. The Puerto Ricans loved their wrestling. In fact, they loved it too much. Fans had to be strongly dissuaded from throwing anything that wasn't tied down into the ring at the heels, who often had to have the police escort from to and from the ring. This is one of the most noticeable things about watching WWC, the militarily uniformed police officers who are genuinely there to protect the wrestlers from the fans, and sometimes it would look like they would much rather prefer having a pop at the wrestlers themselves. Abdullah's key feuds of the 80s happened here. He was welcomed with open arms. His wild brawling style, his terrifying presence, his natural toughness, and his willingness to bleed almost non-stop were just what the medics ordered. Of course, it was Colin who had set up Abdullah and keep him bubbling near the top of the card for years on end. The matches were purely promotional magic. Not great wrestling spectacles for sure, but for sheer brutality and fan reaction, well worth seeking out. WWC was an NWA affiliate at the time, enabling them to bring in the big matches for the big cars, and in return they would send their big matches to other territories. This matchup was a key draw for the first Starrcade. Colin was actually a very good mat wrestler, but he knew what his public wanted, and they wanted gore and lots of it. His taffy pink forehead was almost as impressively scarred up as Abdullah's three-notch cranium, and their matches would show how they got that way with an incredible amount of headbutts and stiff kicks. Colon, though the face of the territory, would not be adverse to breaking the rules himself, in one notable encounter producing his own fork, but the surreal endings would continue. Ref bumps and DQs would be the order of the day. Why have a concluding chapter when we can come back and fill the place next week? Of course, Colon would have to have his day, but there were plenty of other people who were beloved in Puerto Rico, so Abdullah could always move on without moving on. Back in 86, before WrestleMania really got going as a drawing card, WWF wrestlers were still taking third-party bookings for other promoters and the money was right. When WWC had San Juan Baseball Stadium to fill, they made the call to Titan Towers to secure the services of Andre the Giant in a one-on-one match with Abdullah. Abdullah was already made his reputation in WWC in his blisteringly hot series with Colon, and being able to pull it off with Andre was a testament to his drawing power. The match starts with Andre showing off his power credentials. By this time in his career, already slowing down, Andre didn't take to action very often. His match against Big John Studd at the previous year's opening WrestleMania was a slow plod of a squash. This was much more even-tempered. As Abdullah took control after 3 minutes using his relative speed and vicious headbutts, he took a long time telegraphing the use of the fork, giving Andre the time to take control of both the cutlery and Abdullah. They brawled off to the dressing room, and not long after. You have to give it to the WWC promoters, an inconclusive and short main event, and the fans came back in droves for more. When a company is hot, it's hot, and they knew how to get the best out of a crowd without causing a riot. Being an NWA affiliate meant regular visitors from all over the world, so when Giant Baba turned up, they kicked off right where they left off in Tokyo. In the one encounter I found, I'm not even sure if they made it to the ring. Well, Abdullah did before Baba was counted out. However, that drawing power from around the world helped bring out the best in Abdullah. For once in his career, he wasn't having to go and freshen himself up, and his regular stints in WWC gave him a good shot of longevity in one territory. The pay was excellent. You only have to look at the number of stadiums they filled, and the opponents matched his style right down to the ground. None better than Frank Bruiser Brody Goodish. Brody had come into the territory for a run at Carlos Colon and had developed quickly from a hated heel to a strong babyface in literally months. He was beloved by the crowd and so had to be turned face. It was a matter of time before he tangled with the Butcher. They had done great business together in Texas when Abdullah was managed by Gary Hart, and their biggest face-off was back in San Juan Baseball Stadium, in front of a packed house. They even put chairs in the infield, which was rare in those days because it meant people could throw things more easily. The pair started off before the announcements. Abdullah finding and chasing Brody down, throwing him into the perimeter fence, slicing him open before the match had even begun. When they did get to the ring, it was testament to how over Brody was, with the crowd singing along with every kick, encouraging the West Texas Monster to destroy Abdullah. But the Butcher kept coming back for more. Tiring of the ring, they set off for their travels again. Brody, now shoeless, chasing Abdullah up the aisles and attempting to remove his head with the retaining wall. They threw everything into this match, and as Brody attacked with every kick and punch, the crowd sang along with a grunt of joy, even when they all could see was a raised fist in the crowd. Sadly, this would be the last high-profile match for Brody in WWC. He would be dead months later, his last opponent being Abdullah. He was killed in very dubious circumstances in a WWC locker room after a TV taping. The Butcher, though, would move on. His last productive run for a major promotion would be in WCW during the post-Flair period of 1992. Sting had been, by that point, so buried in the promotional issues of the company, they needed something to seriously freshen up his character, and they would put him in real jeopardy in the fans' eyes. Going for an old-school approach, Abdullah was brought in as a monster to be vanquished, as was Cactus Jack McFoley. Abdullah hung around for long enough to start a new heel tag team that helped enhance Cactus Jack and give Sting some nightmares. Sadly, it wasn't to be for the long term. He wasn't about to work for Bill Watts when he came in as the new boss, and he set off on his travels again. And he's still travelling to this day. He makes trips for the independent promotions all over the world. He is still a controversial figure. He lost a lawsuit after wrestling Devon Nicholson in 2007, in which Nicholson reportedly contracted hepatitis C during a match, but he still keeps going even at 74, for promotions that want the Wild Man one last time. His reputation and his ring style have served him well, and it is a testament to his will to keep going. His last match of note will be with fellow Violence Vanguards of both male and female wrestling teaming with Gammy against Aja Kong and Nassawa Ranagai for Wave Pro Wrestling after a crash challenge from Gammy to Aja. He proved that he was an equally opportunity slice and dice machine to either gender, including his own tag partner, and whoever got in the way. The man was presented as unstoppable, just as the Japanese fans wanted him to be. Even if he couldn't climb into the ring without some help, he was still the Butcher. As we know now, Abdullah is retired. He is gone from the pro wrestling game. And I, for one, am thankful he left in one piece. I am hoping he has a nice and sensible retirement. But he is Abdullah the Butcher, and he was one of the greatest monsters in pro wrestling history. Take care, have a good week, we'll speak to you soon. Bye! Telling Stories is part of the Treepenny Show podcast network channel. You can find us on the internet at Treepenny Show, The Treepenny Show on Facebook. Theme song by Sheriff Lone Star and the Deputies of Heartbreak called Salmon Salad Boogie. Find at Bandcamp / Sheriff Lone Star.